Good idea. Good idea. Not all of us are used to living in these kind of climates. I grew up in northern Wisconsin, where it was even colder than it is here, but as soon as I discovered there were warmer places, I left. Anyway, what we thought we would do, our charming chair lady, chairperson, might be a good idea. What we're going to do for the rest of the morning is take up step six. But first of all, maybe we can spend a few minutes on discussion of the steps we just talked about, four and five, if you'd like. If you have any discussion or want to vent a feeling or ask a question or do whatever you like to do, come. Otherwise, I'll just talk incessantly. Incidentally, I would say in passing, I had not intended to put those on the board. I didn't think they'd be deathless prose, but a couple of people at the break asked me if I'd write them down, so that's what it's about. And I'm not saying they're better or worse than anything else, than just something I've used successfully over the years. And it gets people going. Anybody discussion on steps four and five? Yes, sir, Derek. I know it's a funny name, but try not to laugh. You'll ruin your self-image. Yes, go ahead.
I'm sure in front of him, the goddess has got me going. I love it. My name's Derek, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Derek.
Glad to be here in case of the sober and a really happy member of the Shepherd Group. I just wanted to comment. I just wanted to comment and say thank you again, as I had in the break, not only for writing down the seven impressions we got, but for seeing that by writing it down, we make the mumble-jumble of our heads finite. And that's such a wrestle with why it works, and you put it clearly, and thank you for that, because with something finite, I can deal one day at a time, I can get into action. But when it's just floating around in the head,
Thank you, Derek. Staples asked me to repeat questions because they can't hear them as you say it. And I really find it hard to repeat that statement, just that he thanked the speaker for being wonderful. Well, he wouldn't want me to lie on tape. Question? Yes, sir.
My son was an alcoholic.
Hi, Tom.
I took fourth and fifth about a year and a half into my sobriety, and I took it because I thought I was going to go crazy and drink. You know, I procrastinated a long time. I had that guy in the fourth step room, and I carried around Hazel's in there. And unfortunately, I didn't use it because they came up with a new guy in the fourth step room. It was great. But anyway, I did it. I was sort of a mountain of things, the way it's done in the big book, and then the problem solved, and then the Hazel's. I did it the best of my ability. I followed my sponsor. I took a few days off working. Anyway, I gave it my best shot. And it was an emotional experience, because that was, you know, years and past. But I have never done it since. And I talked to my friends in AA, and they said, well, I just did my 12th, 4th step. No, it makes me feel guilty. You know, do you believe in taking the 4th step over and over and over and over again? The
question is, some people in AA take a 4th step over and over again. I'm just repeating for the tape. And some people don't. Well, my personal opinion, that's all I speak for, of course, is that nowhere in the literature that I've read or the experience I've seen does it talk about a continuing 4th step. In my opinion, that can easily turn into an ongoing, socially acceptable self-obsession. That's my opinion. I know people in AA who just can't wait to, every time they have a problem, to get home and write about it. I get up and write about it. They can never do anything about it, but they can write about it. And I think we haven't, there may be a case for a second, fourth step further into your sobriety as things surface that you didn't have in your first, fourth step. But for the ongoing business of living, that's why we have a tenth step. I'm supposed to deal with it then and correct it, not let it build up until I can finally vomit it out in another fourth step. But I guess there's no right way to do it, but I know of nothing in AA or experience of Bill Wilson or anybody else that would suggest there's an ongoing series of fourth steps, in my opinion. And I secretly feel the opinion of Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob in heaven. That's only our opinion. Anything? Any other?
How can you tell the difference between an ongoing fourth step and an ongoing tenth step?
Tenth steps are supposed to be ongoing. Fourth steps, I think as he refers to it, well, let me repeat this for the tape. What's the difference between an ongoing fourth step and an ongoing tenth step? An ongoing fourth step is a fourth step, traditionally where you sit down and write at length and so on, and then you take a fifth step with a sponsor or with someone else. An inventory, a tenth step is where you, at the end of each day, you examine how you're going, what you've been, you balance what you're doing, and reform. The difference between, fourth step, it's an enormous thing where you get the truck going. And a tenth step is you steer it. You've got to keep steering all the time. If you don't like that analogy, I'll think of another one. Yeah, not bad. I'll just chop that down, too. I'm certainly glad I came to this meeting. I needed it. I can't read that. Yes, ma'am.
In the big book, when you talk about the 47,
yep.
Says that a business that doesn't take inventory is sure to go out of business.
Yep.
And a business, he draws that analogy. If you don't do this, and I'm going to counter with Johnson, I found for myself that I needed to do this several times as I've grown more aware or gotten to know myself a little better, that I've needed to deal with some of these emotions.
Well,
in the 10th step, I'm admitting, or, confidently admitting that I've done something or that I've felt something, but I'm not necessarily going to my sponsor and saying, oh, here's this revelation. I feel like this about myself, or I've done this and this and this to get love.
Well, there's a point of view. As I say, I would have no exception to whatever works for people. And in my opinion, I've seen people take two big inventories. But I also know people have created so far that they write inventories incessantly. They're so they cannot function in the world. There's a kind of way to go home and write about every time they have a feeling. Human feelings, it's an endless job to keep writing, well, I had this feeling, I had rage today. We all had rage today, for Christ's sake, The point is it something that's really deep, or is it just somebody made me upset? Common sense. Well, I don't like to hear that kind of talk. I've sunk pretty low, but I haven't sunk to that point. The Gills? Yes, ma'am.
I'm not clear on why you would find what unrealistic or impossible.
Oh. I want to be President of the United States. I want to be a movie star. I want to be a millionaire. In other words, you might not put down goals that you thought were unrealistic, but put down whatever they are. These two really have nothing to do with the inventory. They just have lead-ins into the next, to lead them into the next steps. Why we want to start doing the things, because all of these steps from three on, all of these.
I can't read that here. I'm just asking what it was. I'm there on the full one.
Well, it's just the answer to happy sobriety, and I'm sorry you'll never find out. It's the formula men have been searching for 10,000 years. And you forgot your glasses. Isn't that the way it always goes? But I think it's safe to say that none of these steps, if they're to be taken right, they all must be in addition to the power greater than ourselves. We must have the security of that in order to do it well, although we may not consciously aware of it. Otherwise, it just gets down to self-will and self-pride, and that isn't enough, because it obscures us. And everything we can do to help reinforce the idea that a power greater than myself is helping me, giving me a little security to do this. I don't think it's possible, unless you surrender to the fact there's a power greater than yourself, I don't see how you can write a successful fourth step. I don't know how you can do anything, make an unpleasant demand, can't do anything that's really worthwhile unless you feel you are surrendering something. Based on my judgment, I wouldn't do that. That's not what I would do. That would not be considered type of therapy that I need for my problem, as I whine to my sponsor, you know. God, I'm so full of pain and guilt now over what I've done. Why should I rip, you know, it's like ripping open scabs. Some of them are maybe healed a little bit. Oh, there's one that almost healed. Here, gotcha. You know, ripping open these same things. Yet it turns out that's how you get rid of it. To get it out of self. And the fifth step, of course, is to, when you take it with yourself, you do it as you write it, and read it. You take it with God, and that's relatively easy, but it's very difficult to take it with another human being. That's where the humbling experience in the step comes, I suppose. That's humiliating, but it's to, you affirm what you have done. You affirm what you've done when you do it with somebody else. There are two steps where they talk about, there really is a great feeling of relief following these steps. One is the fifth step, because you've done it with someone else. One is the ninth step, where you've done it with other people. When you're doing it with others, when you're getting out of self. Because it seems to me, for self-obsessed people, all of us, the exercise of AA is always getting out of self. Getting out of self. Because self-obsession, just left untended, comes right back in constantly. I think there's an interesting, again, this is really highly basic, oversimplified, but it's true, I would say. One of the things that enables human beings to survive in the world, probably the most important thing that we are born with, is a sense of self-preservation. And that's what enables the species to survive, a sense of self-preservation. Without that, we would not survive. And we're born, all of us are born into a world that is an ideal world, where we are the focus of the entire universe. Unfortunately, we're too little to enjoy it. But you know, when a baby lies there, he gets hungry. He says, ah! Oh, baby's hungry. Here. They don't say, get a job, you little son of a bitch. When you wet your pants, mothers can tell the difference in those cries. Fathers can't. I fed a lot of kids with wet pants in my day. Eat it, you say you're hungry, eat it. But you dry your pants and everything. It's just wonderful. Everything, you start to crawl and look at baby. Pulled over the lap. How strong. Next year, what? But for a while, the world is my baby. I'm the focus of everything. Whenever I have a want, isn't it a shame? It just comes when you don't understand, you don't realize it, but it's just the way I'd like to have it now, and it isn't. And it's just wonderful. One day, you go into a little room, perhaps your living room or somewhere, and there's another little child who up to then was the center of his universe, and you hear the beginnings of life. Mine. Mine. Quack! And the battle of life begins, never to end. Ever. Till you die. You discover you are in the world with a bunch of selfish, stinking, lousy people who think their needs are as tough as yours. Or as important. And as you grow up, you learn that you must give to get. You have to play games with people. You must disguise your real wants. You have to say, gee, Ma, you're sure pretty. That's such a pretty dress, Ma. Can I have a dime to go to the show, Ma? All the little games that go into growing up and disguising things. And It's a funny thing, really, the maturing process, to all intents and purposes, the maturing process is really a continuing process to disguise what you really feel. You call yourself mature when you don't show your emotions on a continuing basis. You grow up, and people grow up. They have these emotions inside, the basic visceral emotions, and the abilities on the outside that enable people to live in a society without living in a cave and hitting people with clubs. You know, the world, we talk about honesty, the world could never exist with honesty. My wife says to me, what do you think of this dress? I think it's grotesque, for Christ's sake. What? I've learned to say, interesting. Very interesting. You know, and it goes on all the time. Bosses say, you like that idea? Sure do. First law of survival in the business jungle, a little brown on the nose puts a little gold in the pocket. And you can poo-poo that in the abstract, but that's the real world in action. And so people grow up in the world. But they are still motivated. But all things being equal, I think it's safe to say, unless they're really unusual or psychotic, you wind up always the same thing. My wishes and needs are more important to me than your wishes and needs are to me. Nothing personal. Right? I can see that I need it and want it more than you do. You could get along without it. I need it. That is why you find people, rich, successful, wonderful people. This, we went through it on the way from the airport again and again. Stoplights. Why do they have stoplights? Because adult, mature people all are convinced it is more important for me to get that, through that intersection than you. And you wait. What? So society's had to say, now you children in the Lincoln, wait your turn and let the little boy in the caddy come through for a while. Okay, now you, just like a grade school, it's just hideous. Because left to my own devices, I want what I want! I can't think of a single major law that is not directly or indirectly designed to protect someone or something from being used by someone or something else for their own purposes. The whole world is, I want what I want, and if it may be what you have, and I'm sorry for you. You learn to get along without it, and you will be happy that I'm enjoying it so much. People sometimes feel people are against them. I spent a lot of my life feeling people were against me. I've come to believe that as a rule, people are never against people. It is in some way that I am a threat to what they want. I am in their way. I threaten them in some way. I'm in somebody's way. If I step out of their way, they're not concerned about me. When people threaten me psychologically or financially or in my way between what I want, then I see them as against me, but not, or they see me as against them. I see people against me. And when I realize I am, they perceive me as a negative force. That's why they're against me. They're not against me because I'm Clancy Emerson. They're against me because I'm between them and what they want somehow. So one of the great things to discover was for me is that when I'm not threatening the people, they don't feel threatened. If they, most of them don't. Some people always will. But this concept of growing up, but you always live with conflicts. Every human being has conflicts. There are a lot of conflicts. Because the world never is designed the way it should be. I get up in the morning, and I feel good, and it's just, go to hell. Not my fault. Not every day, no. It will still get over that. But 99 days out of 100, yeah. And I think things are happening to me. And it turns out things aren't happening to me. I get up in the morning and say, traffic jam! Damn it! Another traffic jam! traffic jam, screw me up. Other days when I'm feeling good, I say, a traffic jam, that happens. I can wait. It's as though there are different kinds of traffic jams. There are. There are just traffic jams. It's how I perceive them is how they are. But everybody lives with conflicts, because what I want is not what you want to give me. And I got to give you something. The goal of life is to see how little do I have to give to get what I want. Whatever it might be, emotions, whatever it might be. This brings about continual conflicts. It's an interesting thing. You know, these conflicts when driven to the extreme, when you become semi-goofy as a result of it, you commit suicide. I'll tell you something funny that you may or may not know. In my work today on Skid Row, I see people die regularly, sometimes every day. Die from alcoholism, die from crack addiction, which is the big new drug that Skid Row can use, that cheap crack, $3 a hit. See people die from hypothermia in the wintertime. People see people knife to death. That's another phenomenon in Southern California. Illegal aliens come up there frightened, they have knives, and people get knives, and these poor pathetic bastards cut into a line and somebody stabs them. See people fall in front of a bus and get run over, their head run over. See all kinds of deaths. But there's one type of death you never see on Skid Row. And it's misery and agony. There's never any suicide. Isn't that funny? You'd think that'd be the number one cause of death in all this agony. Why is there no suicide? Because they've given up the outside. They just have the inside. There's no outside. They don't have to pretend to feel differently than they do. You know, commit suicide? People who look like you and me. You get up every morning, no matter how you feel, you got to suck it together. Go out there and smile at a dirty bastard you like to take an Uzi to. Hi, how are you? How have you been? How's the family? Come home at night and have that beast nag at you and those unnatural children raised. Problems, money, no. Now, a lot of people have tools to diffuse that. We all do. But if you don't, it builds up. Continuing conflict can really push you into such a state of conflict that it overrides the most important instinct you have, which is self-preservation. I will finish self-preservation. And most of the tools that people like us have to live with is finding ways to deal with this conflict. Because I say on Skid Row, we talk about in AA, living one day at a time. That's where they live one day at a time. Every day is just just get through today. It's a hell of a way to live, but they live with terrible pain and agony and filth, but no suicides, because at least they don't have to pretend. That's why it's almost impossible to take people off Skid Row and get them back in the world. Because they don't, if they ever had it, they've lost it. The ability to cope with a structured world that's full of conflict. All structured worlds are full of conflict. So, their conflicts are quite simple. Having something to eat, find a place to sleep. Very simple. There's no, have to worry about the report that's supposed to be in at 10 o'clock. Or the girl, the only girl I've ever loved, has gone back to her husband. Or on and on, all the various conflicts that go in the world. So we all have to deal with conflict. And that's what makes it so difficult, because each of us feel our conflicts, many times, feel are indigenous to us only. That's what makes my case different. And that's why I think, and I've worked very hard to deal with those conflicts, and that's why I think Bill Wilson calls step 6 the one that separates the men from the boys. Because now you have to be willing to give up defects of character. You've got to be willing to give up defects of character, and the defects of character are primarily tools you've used to help you cope with conflict. And I've got to be willing to give them up. And it's a frightening thing, you know, because I remember thinking, if I give up all those conflict, if I give up all these defects of character, I'll become perfect. And he says, I don't have to be perfect. Chapter 5. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are, we seek progress, not perfection. And that's a It would be a bad step to take at this time to become perfect. And if I do have to give up some things, let me decide the order I give them up, you know. I'm going to give up everything. Just like we were talking at breakfast this morning about, we were talking politics at breakfast, which you never want to do at breakfast. Because I'm going to get that guy tonight when he's sleeping. I'm going to... For his own good, not for mine. But we're discussing about how politicians economize. They're all in favor of economy. Yes, I want economy. Yes, yes, yes. But we'll start with your district. My district needs what it's got. And that's the way it is with defects of character. I'm willing to give up defects of character. All of them. Lust? Well, let's start with murder. I'm going to give up murder. Then I'm going to give up. I'm going to give up piracy. I'm going to give up these things one by one, and I'm going to get to lust sometime later. But now they want us to make a commitment to give up everything. And we can't possibly give up everything. It always struck me that the sixth step is a very important step, because I must make a decision. Am I willing to give it up? I don't see how I can give it up, and it may not happen in the foreseeable future, but I have to be willing to give it up. I have to sign an agreement in principle with the divine corporation saying, I'm not sure how we're going to tie it all together, but in principle, I'm willing to make the sale. I'm going to give it all up. And it's hard because there's a lot of things involved in giving up these things. And it entails a lot. It entails a lot of fear. My friend Sandy Beach in Washington uses a story a lot that I think entails. He talks about a little boy wakes up in the night, 2 o'clock in the morning, he's got a toothache. And he knows that 2 aspirins will make it better. But he doesn't call for his mother. And at 3 o'clock, still aching. And at 4 o'clock, it's still aching. And finally he gets so bad, he says, Mother, yes, I've got a toothache. Well, I'll get you 2 aspirins. And she brings the 2 aspirins. That's all right. Now the question is, why did he hold off? And the answer is very simple. It's the same reason we hold off when we deal with God, I think. He holds off because he knows there's going to be a hell of a lot more to it than 2 aspirins. The next morning she's going to say, Sonny, we're going to have to make a dental appointment for you. I don't want a dental appointment. My toothache's gone. Good thing to do. And you have to go to the dentist. And he's going to say, which tooth is sore? But he's not going to stop there. He's going to check all your teeth. You're going to find 8 more cavities. You're going to make 12 appointments. It's going to be endless goddamn horror and pain forever. It's easier to lie awake and see if that toothache will go away. No end to it. Same thing with these things. I will try to survive the pain of these defects of character a little while. Maybe they'll ease up. I hate to take them to God because God knows where it'll end then. You know, I might become perfect and become really a drag. There's a lot more to it than the 2 aspirins that you take. And that's what the fear is, the fear of the unknown, the fear that we're going to have to give up everything. I'm sure some of you felt this way. The only pleasures I have in life are my defects of character. I have to watch them, of course, but I mean, now you want me to give those up and go back to the very reason I drank. One of the reasons is because even with the defects of character and drinking, of course, life was just an endless gray tunnel. And that's what's wrong with AA. When you're new, you go to AA, and it's an endless gray tunnel. You give up whatever drinking, whatever technicolor there is, and you're going to be in this gray tunnel and become perfect for the rest of your life. And get little thin blue lips. And say, I don't believe I'd care to do that. That seems to be fun. And there's never any rewards. You might look ahead. Is there any reward if there? Yes, after a year of endless pain, a hatch opens, the scrawny iron breath, and says, here's the medallion. Is that all there is? That's all. Oh! That is not quite what I had in mind. That seems to work for others, but my case is different. I have more sophisticated needs, I guess. So the sixth step is a difficult step. I must become willing to have God remove all these defects of character. Either I must become willing to do what is necessary to remove them over a period of time. That's really what I'm saying. Am I willing to do what is necessary? Am I again invoking the power of God to help me take actions that I am afraid of and want to withdraw from? So the sixth step is really not terribly complex, but yet it's a great dividing point. Two great turning spots in all of AA. Fourth step, where I'd say 75% of people who come to AA never take a fourth step, or maybe higher. In fact, you know, when you stop to think about it, there's a, someone in the big book, Bill talks about there's more people, or there's 12, but anyway, he talks about for everybody in AA, there's some people out in the street who've been to AA. It's my experience, I would bet today that, I bet there are 10 people or more who have been in AA and sober who are back drinking for every member of AA that's sober. I don't know any long-term drinkers, for example, on Skid Row, who haven't been to AA and been sober. I don't know, I know very few old long-term drinkers who haven't been to AA somewhere along the line and been sober and come to the realization that AA does not work for them. And in almost every case, they've stopped at one of two turning spots. They've been sober, but they have stopped at a fourth step, or they stopped at a sixth step. Very few people have taken all the steps and have gone back out quickly. You can when you're an old timer. You can take all these steps, and eventually you go back out. We know how that works. But the actions, I have to take actions now that don't seem to apply to my problems sometimes in these steps, and they're frightening. Someone asked me to briefly an analogy I used one time when I was talking, and I sometimes use analogies that are so strained I can't even bear to think about them later, but this one was a good one. I was using it as an analogy about good and bad treatment centers. When I was new, there weren't any treatment centers. I know. Sanitarium, trying out spots. And over the years, treatment centers sprung up and chains of them and individuals, and some of them were good, and most old-timers hated them. Yeah, treatment center! Ah! But as years went by, I noticed some people were doing quite well out of treatment centers, some weren't. And good treatment centers are indeed a great help. I think statistics indicate if you've been to a treatment center, go to AA, your chances are considerably better than just going to AA or just going to a treatment center. Because at least you're sober in some possession of your faculties when you get to AA and you've had some free learning. But what's the difference between the two treatment centers? And the analogy I used is like, why would people want to go to a treatment center today when AA is free and costs thousands of dollars to go to treatment? It's like going down here to the lake and wanting to go to Cleveland. And here's a trim little yacht, skiff, schooner, called the SS Treatment Center. People in white, clean white uniforms. You want to come with us? We're going to. Shoving off in a minute. Smell of good food wafting out of the kitchen, out of the galley. It's just wonderful. Down the beach here, two guys kind of skulking around some tall grass and saying, you want to go with us? We're from AA. We got an invisible boat. It really is no great put down to say, personally would prefer to get on the skiff, you know. Want to wish you a lot of luck, guys. But and you go to the SS treatment center, and it pulls up, and it does exactly what it says it to. Keeps you warm, dries you out, gives you some information about your problem, feeds you well, makes you well. Everything's great. Only one problem with it. He just gets out of sight of land. He says, well, this is as far as we go. We're going to go back and get the next load. Well, what am I supposed to do? Swim like a sumbitch. And you start swimming, and here come these two fools by in their invisible boat. You want a ride? I'm not that sick. Okay. Put your, as you dry off, you realize, I'm just floating above the water. There's no boat here. This is crazy. What do you want me to do? Well, grab an oar and row. And finally, you're almost dead, and they come by again. What do I? Okay. They pull you in. What do you want me to do? Get an oar and row. You crazy bastard. And the irony is, as you start to row, the boat appears. But it doesn't appear until you start to row. So you have to be kind of desperate. As you start to row, the boat appears. It gets bigger and better. Much finer than that little skiff. You don't even want to go to Cleveland. You just want to stay in the boat. Hell with it. Let's turn this way. Hey, hey, hey. And, that's great. That's why we have sponsors. They come every once in a while. You slow down. What's wrong? You got your oar upside down. Oh, yeah, go ahead. One of the reasons we get together at these meetings is to remind one another to keep rowing. To keep rowing. That's what we do. There's no new information here after a while. You can just keep rowing. Reinforce that. Keep rowing. God will help you row. Keep rowing. When you're tired and the rain is falling and you're cold, row. It's better. And that's fine, except for one thing. We see it around us. I hope it never happens to me or you. But you can stop rowing, you're on a great thing. If you stop rowing long enough, the boat starts to disappear, little by little. We've all watched old-timers who have had big ships, and they're back in the water, and they can't understand it. Jack and I were talking on the way over here from the airport about old-timers we have known who have gotten drunk and couldn't get back. I'll tell you why they can't get back. They say, I'll do anything to get back to my big ship. But you can't have your big ship back. You got to row and start with a little boat again. Don't want to do that. I know about that. I'll get back. And they die. That's why it says people, a rule of thumb, relatively accurate, I suppose, that if you've been sober over 7 or 8 years and you get drunk, the chances of you getting back are remarkably slim. Some people do, but it's very rare because they want to get back to a big ship. And they can't. Now, what's this got to do with treatment facilities? Well, there are treatment facilities who, in my opinion, are almost literally killing people. As I said earlier, they have to take the 12 steps. They read intellectual literature. They get psychoanalyzed. They get the bonding with their counselor. And they leave the facility thinking that they have recovered. And they now can do it. And if you have troubles, call your counselor. Call aftercare, but I mean, if you want to go to some place like AA, that's fine. But you have enough information to stay sober, and they literally kill people like us. The good treatment centers say, "Look, you got information. You're dry. You're feeling good. Now we're leaving you in the water. For God's sakes, when those two pukes come by in the invisible boat, jump in right now. You don't have to believe it. Just do it." The ones that guide us into AA are prized beyond belief. The ones who, for their own reasons, for money-making or pride or ego, would lead you to believe that your information will make you well, will kill you. And I think that's what most of the things we do. And one of the great problems we have to face when we first get in the boat is rowing through a fourth step. It doesn't even have any reason for doing it. and rowing through six steps, which gets us apparently someplace we don't want to be. But all the things here are designed to little by little bring about a goal we never could have conceived could happen based on our intellect. We'll talk about a little bit more about it tomorrow morning. But what is the goal of all of these steps? To make you wonderful? No. To make you above human? No. To make you without emotion? No. It's to very, very slowly do what alcohol does fast. To little by little take people who are not enough and make them feel most of the time like they're enough. To take people who live with fear and most of the time live without being terrified. To little by little take people who feel highly vulnerable and most of the time feel invulnerable, or at least not highly vulnerable. And it's hard to explain that to new people because there's just no way to get from here to there. It's hard to do that even in the sixth step when you're that far along. But at least when you've taken the sixth step, you have now accepted the premise, there is a way for me to go, and I'm in the middle of doing it, and I'm going to keep trying. And what we can do as individuals is remember to take those steps, and what we can do as sponsors is to guide people into taking them. Love will not keep people sober. Spirituality will not keep people sober. Not alcoholics of my type. You know, the insight, I mean, these are all great adjuncts. Always the interesting example of that. Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob meeting on Mother's Day in 1935. And Dr. Bob was already a spiritual leader in the Oxford group in Ohio, but still was drinking. Bill Wilson was a member of the Oxford group for 6-7 months in New York. And they got together for 2 weeks in Dr. Bob's house and discussed spiritual values and spiritual breakthroughs and insights and God's will. And Dr. Bob got drunk. And when he sobered up this time, they realized that is not Bill Wilson stayed sober. He stayed sober by trying to help people on the streets of New York. So they went up and went to the Akron Hospital and found AA number 3. And the three of them found AA number 4. And they find our book. It says, action is the magic word. You must take the actions. The spiritual adjuncts are what come with it. But most of us would like to find a way to not do the action, but to bury ourselves and say, well, I'm just finding the spiritual concepts. I don't want to be done with that crass stuff. That's meaningless. That's just another nice way, in my opinion, of an easier, softer self-obsession. Getting out of self. Self-obsessed people getting out of self. People who have spent their whole lives trapped in conflicts between their inside and outside. I got certain techniques and people don't like them, but God damn it, they enable me to survive. Now you want me to give up? Got to be willing. Give it a try. Maybe it'll work. Thank you. You want to come up and say a few words? What?
I'm going to say a few words.
Oh, I'm talking to her, but if you want to, that's okay.
Hi, everybody. I'm Maggie. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Maggie.
I just want to thank Clancy for a beautiful morning, for beautiful sharing.
We were going to have a little discussion on the step.
Well, that's what I was going to sort of do a group conscience about. We were going to wrap up by 11, but I'm quite willing if you want to have about another 10 minutes of discussion is just fine. Discussion or sharing? Okay.
Discussion.
All in favor of discussion, aye.
Aye. Well, I wanted to get back to my room and worry.
Who would like to kick it off?
Yeah, I'm curious. These two steps, we're talking about 6 steps. Because you're willing to have God really to do that. Humbly ask Him for really to do that. And then it goes on, if you read the chapters, it has nothing to do with God. You've got to do it. It seems to be a bit of a scam here. You know. Seriously.
Yeah, but don't tell the newcomer.
Well,
no, I know you're saying.
It pointed out to me, and I noticed it right from the very beginning.
That's right. Well, my answer to that would be, let me talk into the microphone, because this may be deathless. I'm not sure yet. The question is, why is it in the sixth, seventh subject we say, we ask God to do these things, and then it turns out we have to do them? I think the answer to that, Tom, is this. What I'm saying in effect is, I have to do them, but I have to do them by taking actions that I don't always believe in. I am turning myself over to the care of God as I understand Him. I am taking actions that I would not take based on my own intelligence or self-evaluation. You understand that? I'm asking God to do this. What I'm saying in effect is, God, I'm going to take these actions of yours even though I don't always believe them. So I'm asking God to do it, but I must do it. But I must do it by taking actions that I do not believe in sometimes. I must, in other words, I'm again asking God to do something for me that I have to do for myself, but I would not do without the security of His person, His being. Is that too abstract? Do you understand that? Let me put it more clearly. I know that. I remember having that feeling years ago. Why even bring God into it? I just have to do it. I'm asking God, of myself, I would never ask anybody to remove my defects, all of my defects of character. Some of them maybe, but not all of them. I have to ask God. That is a surrender. I'm going to ask God to help me become willing to surrender my defects of character. Now, I would not do that of myself. I'm asking God to help me do it. Help me become willing. Because of myself, I would never become willing. And the seventh step, which I'm going to talk a little later about, ask Him to remove these defects, is I'm not sure that I want them removed, but I'm surrendering to God. In other words, I'm asking God to do something that I'm afraid to do on my own. And to bring this about, I have to take actions. It's just like asking God to get me, God, help me get to Toronto. But I have to start moving. But I'm asking God to help me. Ask me. God, I think one of the great prayers in the 12th step, or the 11th step, that I think is the most impressive prayer of all the prayers in Alcoholics Anonymous, it's the one I've stuck with the most, praying only for knowledge of God's will for me and the strength to carry it out. Because otherwise I get into dickering and promising and manipulating. But that's what I'm doing there. I'm saying, God, help me remove these defects of character. Help me to stay willing to do it. Help me to override my own damn selfishness and self-centeredness long enough to occasionally do something that will get me out of it. Now, I am doing it, but I'm asking God for the power. Is that clear? Well, not to me. Yeah, it is. It is. Give your hand up. I thought you were taking your pulse.
You mentioned, the fact that we are stimulating conflict. And our defects we use as aspects to operate in the world that we're in. We use these defects as a sort of framework in dealing with people. And then this framework is obviously not used enough. Be successful because you get it out, not dealing with conflict, really. So what you're saying, what we have to do is then, is take away those defects. And I understood this concept of, holding the door, we were talking this morning, I was saying, therefore I'm taking away these defects which were my tools of dealing with the conflict, not being successful tools. Okay, my last question is, now when I remove these with God's help, the fear then is what I'm left with to deal with the conflict, right? And then it comes to me then I have to change my life, don't I? Great kids have revelation that I have to find another tool. So I have to change my
No, I'd like to put a qualification on when I have done the simple, when I've recognized my defect. I'm taking away my way of dealing with conflict. Then I'm left. How do I avoid the election I go with?
Well,
is the fear?
As I understand the fear. It's the fear of the little boy. If I say I got a toothache, I'm going to have to go to the dentist for the next 18 weeks. I would say that the defects of character we use as tools, in my experience, have been predicated on the fact that of myself, I am not enough. I always need a little edge to win. In other words, I cannot win based on myself. I got to have something extra going for me. So I use little tools, little shortcuts, little hustles, little deals, and now they want me to give up those things and operate just normally, straightforward. And that is frightening to me because I don't think I'll be enough to do it. And that is what I think over a period of time you discover in age to the best of your ability, you try to give up those things as much as possible, and you operate straightforward and you operate without guile, and it seems like you're just highly vulnerable. You know, like you say, you're having a bad morning and I'll slip away to a noon meeting. But I know if I do that, that's the very time my competitor will get a big sale and I won't. I better sit here. And it's hard to realize that. I'll tell you an example of that. My sponsor, Chuck C. If you ever read this, he did this Paula Mesa retreat where he talks about it at length in the book, New Pair of Glasses. But that's a good example of it. Where he, after he was sober a little while, he decided that he would just run his business straightforward and honest. And he would do whatever necessary to be a good businessman. I mean, he designed the insides of supermarkets. And he had a couple of examples where the guy said, I don't like this. He said, okay, I'll do it again for nothing. It's going to cost me thousands of dollars, but I'll do it again. Because I want to do it to make you happy. And his fellows in the business were saying, hey, we're in deep, you know, you keep doing this, Chuck, and we're out of business. We can't do this. But as it turned out, he did it this way, and he couldn't handle the business after a while. He was turning away business. He became a multimillionaire by not having an edge. When he had an edge, he was just fairly well-to-do. But when he became straightforward, he became a multimillionaire. Now, I'm not saying that if you conduct yourself as an honest citizen, you become a multimillionaire. But I would say that being a multimillionaire was not as important to Chuck as sleeping well and feeling good. And that's what you get to. You sleep well and you feel good. I run a mission on Skid Row, as you know. Some years ago I resigned a job in Beverly Hills where I was quite successful, and I run a mission on Skid Row where I get paid considerably less than I might make in the real world. And it's a funny thing. People drive their Mercedes and their BMWs down to talk to me at the mission on how to feel comfortable. They could all buy and sell the mission and work it. But what good does it do if you can't sleep at night and you feel terrible? What we have in common, what I have, you know, over the years I had a chance to sponsor a lot of people. The guy who put the flag on the moon, and movie stars, and priests, and psychiatrists, and bums. What we all have in common is that we've all come from a field where sobriety is untenable, and drinking is untenable. And we have to take techniques to get rid of it. And stopping drinking is not enough, so we have to work on sobriety. As we've talked about the last few hours, we have to give up things that seem to be the only defenses we have against the world. And I don't think any one of us are ever in any danger of becoming perfect or wonderful. I don't think it's because it's just not the human condition. But I must be willing to try, to be straightforward. To me, as I mentioned last night briefly, some of the greatest spiritual concepts I ever learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, the things that changed my life as much as anything I know, are things such as, do what you said you would do. Be where you said you would be when you said you would be there, or let them know you're not coming. Don't take out your pent-up hostilities on people who can't answer back, such as your children, waiters and waitresses, employees. You know, where you just pent up, and most of us have been in that habit, come home and just, it's been crappy out there, you gotta take that crap. We don't take it from a kid. Get to your room. And, try not to do that. I remember telling my sponsor, I was kind of new. I said, So I'm sitting there, she says, I know you. She heard me taking it out on the woman serving coffee at the club. And she said, an employee. God damn it, give me the coffee. You got to learn not to. I've got to get it out. He said, there's Mike Ross. Mike Ross was a guy 6'6", big ex-football player. He said, someone tell that Mike Ross. He says, you better will. I believe I can stuff it after all. But it's so easy to slide into that cheap gratification of taking it out on people who can't answer back. If you want to take it out on someone who can answer back. Take it out on an equal or someone superior. And it's amazing how your attitude changes. But these are the great spiritual values of me. Operating decently. Another thought, you know. Trying to wish for people what you wish you had, could get. Jack and I talked about this earlier. But all the things that go into it. I don't think there's any danger in the sixth step that you and I are going to become saints. But we have to become willing to try to take care of these things as they crop up. I hope that answers your question. I don't know any better way. I might as well go eat lunch after a while, huh?